Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Monday. It feels so good that it's finally Monday again, and we got a great Monday program for you. Second hour, Carlo will be here. And we're going to talk about why Jesus, and this is a good one if you are maybe not a Christian and you haven't accepted the Christian faith and you're not sure why folks do. If you want to talk about why people accept Jesus and why you too should accept Jesus, second hour, perfect opportunity for you. This hour, we'll do tips for defending the faith. If you'd like some tips on how to defend the faith against various arguments, or maybe there's something that you've heard that you just don't know how to answer that one, well, just give us a call. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour, Trent Horn. That's a big way to start the week. Hi, Trent.
Hey, Si. I like the title for Carlo's Hour. I like that we're short to the point, but with punctuation, you could really change things. Like if you added a comma,
Jesus.
And if you added a comma and a question mark, why Jesus?
Yeah.
It's like, are you sure it's why Jesus or why Jesus? Why?
I'm sure that Carlo will take questions of either kind.
But that's my, yeah.
Sometimes my the question. Second ones we just can't answer in this life. We're just going to have to be patient and wait. Again, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If there's some aspect of the Catholic faith, maybe something about Catholic morals that you would like help defending, maybe you would like some help defending the doctrines of the faith, maybe the person of Jesus or the Gospels or sacraments, 888-318-7884. You are welcome to call. You are welcome to participate. Tips for defending the faith with our very own Trent Horn. Have you been traveling at all, Trent, or are you stuck at home?
Well, I was most recently actually in San Diego filming a course for our Catholic Answers School of Apologetics on Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, you did? Oh, good for you.
Go ahead.
No, that's all right. I just hear about you behind your back. From the video guys, and they're like, Trent is so prepared. He just comes in and marches through it.
Yeah, well, I try to get the scripts done quick and ready to go. And then what am I thinking about? Sorry, I don't know why I just had a I had a Cy Kellett moment there for a second.
That's what Joe Heschmeyer calls him. Is that going around now? Are we calling that a Cy Kellett moment? Come on now.
Is it? I don't know. So yeah, so I was there and then when I was filming for the Jehovah's Witnesses dialogue, I also filmed an episode of my podcast that's gonna release next Monday. It's a 2-hour long dialogue with a prominent Christian musician who left the Christian faith, actually. So,
is he one of those guys that posted it on Facebook or YouTube? Why I'm leaving Christian?
Yes, and it is a man. I will.
I wasn't supposed to.
So that's the only clue. That's the only clue I'm going to give. So okay. It is a gentleman. There's others, individuals I'd love to talk to, but we had a great conversation. His deconversion actually did make national news when it happened last year. So he and I, we had a great 2-hour conversation about it, and I challenged him a little, and he challenged me, and we went back and forth. And I think it'd be a good model of how we need to dialogue with people. So that's going to air next Monday. But if you want to go and check out all that and more on my podcast, that's Council of Trent, Trent Horn Podcast. .com. Definitely check that out.
I got to say, I find the whole thing of when Christian ministers post their why I'm not Christian anymore video or take or whatnot, I don't get it at all. I don't understand that at all, why someone would do that.
Well, I think he wanted to explain, I mean, why he's not going to be a Christian musician anymore. He had already been pretty public about his faith, so I think he felt the need to let people know what was going on with him. So, but yeah, it's a tough call to make. Like when do you, make this, public or not? When is it appropriate? So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I guess I'll try to have charitable thoughts about it. I just don't get it.
Maybe you'll change your mind after watching it next week.
Okay, fair enough. TrentHornPodcast.com is where you can get Trent's stuff. It's super popular, though, so be careful. You'll be joined by thousands of other people when you're viewing it. TrentHornPodcast.com.
I don't think literally. I don't think 1,000 people will show up at your house. If that does happen,
call
let
Trent.
Me know. Sounds like a rock party.
Okay, so I don't know. Can I go to the phones now or not? Okay, I wasn't sure if the phones were working. All right, it's tips for defending the faith this hour. Trent Horn is our guest. Your call's welcome. There's actually one line open right now, 888-318-7884. Going to Tom in New Jersey, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Tom. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hello, Trent. So you've probably observed by now that pro-choice people are sometimes guilty of bringing up red herrings when they're advocating for their position, like
only at the fish market
from the issue.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So an example is a while back on the show, you had a caller who said, "I'm pro-choice because some women can't afford to raise a child," and then you asked him in reply, "Okay, do you think Kim Kardashian should be allowed to have an abortion because money's no object for her?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's still her choice." And then you said, "Okay, so your whole economic thing is just a red herring because that distracts from the issue.
I don't remember saying that. Maybe I'm having a Syke Hellett moment right now, but that's
a good example. If you are, then Syke Hellett is having a Syke Hellett moment too, because
it was
I didn't
over a year ago.
Oh, over a year ago. Well, I mean.
Yeah,
Trent has three children. I think 6 months is the farthest you can ask him to go back.
Well, you know, I'm glad you say that because I forgot I made that example. So now I'm going to steal it back from myself to use. So thank you.
Plagiarism.
Okay, so right, yeah. So you're right. There are arguments that it's irrelevant to the main issue. But what are some more of your thoughts?
Yeah. So my question is, I'm worried that pro-life people are sometimes guilty of making a similar mistake. So what they'll do is they'll make arguments like, so a woman who's pregnant, she has chose to engage in sexual intercourse, and because of that, she is responsible for children that come into existence as a result of that act, which if I were someone who was on the fence and you gave that argument to me, I would ask in reply, okay, so it sounds like you're saying if a woman didn't engage in sexual intercourse, therefore she is not responsible, and then you would reply, oh, no, she shouldn't be allowed to have an abortion either. And I would say, okay, so it looks like your point about engaging in sexual intercourse is just a red herring, because either way, whether she did or not, whether she was a victim of rape or she engaged in consensual intercourse, she can't have it either way. So it sounds like the whole responsibility thing that you bring up in your book and a lot of other pro-life people do is a similar mistake to that thing that the pro-choice caller did.
What do you think, Trent?
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel there. So in the first case, the attempt to now what's interesting there is you're right. Sometimes the red herrings are valid. Sometimes they aren't. I think the point is that someone says abortion is justified in the case of poverty. And then you say, what about a really rich woman? They'll say, oh, well, there it's justified on the grounds of, let's say, bodily autonomy. I think what they might end up saying, the abortion defender, is, well, something can be justifiable for multiple reasons. So like when the poverty example comes up, I sometimes bring up, what about someone who's rich? But I usually say, well, imagine you had a 2-year-old and you were really poor. Would you say it's okay to end their life because of poverty? They'll say no. And I think that exposes the problem with the argument. Now, and I think this comes up a lot also when people bring up the issue of what about abortion in the case of rape, because they often believe abortion should be legal for multiple reasons. But I'm willing to grant their case that there could be multiple justifications for abortion if the unborn are not human beings. So if the unborn are not human beings, it would be justified based on autonomy. And then also autonomy and a sense of like need, like, oh, I really need this also, poverty or things like that. So I think the red herring can be helpful there about showing that poverty is the weaker reason. And it gets you to the stronger reason of, well, are they human or not? Or do you have bodily autonomy or not? With the case, though, of responsibility of entering into pregnancy, so there, if I'm willing to grant there are multiple reasons to defend abortion, one is weaker than the other, and the question, the Kim Kardashian example, exposes that really you should be talking about the stronger reason, not the weaker reason, I could apply that to the issue of abortion being wrong, that abortion could be immoral for multiple reasons, like the bodily autonomy argument, saying that, you know, if you are responsible for the creation of a new human life or a new entity, you have obligations to that being. but you might also have obligations to a being, even if you did not create him or her. It's just more obvious you have obligations in virtue of your responsibility. So I guess, Tom, maybe like to give an analogy. Like, let's imagine philosophy, let's say Jones and Smith. Jones recklessly starts a campfire and fails to put it out, and he starts a forest fire, yet he does. And so we would say, does Jones have a responsibility to alert the authorities to stop it? I would say, well, yeah, he does. He started that fire. He's got to do something. Now imagine Smith sees there's a fire. He didn't start it, but it would be a gigantic inconvenience to his plans to drive from this rural area to go alert people. Some people might be divided there. Like, maybe Smith doesn't really have an obligation. Other might say, well, if the burden's not that great and there's a great risk to life and health, Smith does have an obligation, even if he didn't start it. That might be, I might make the analogy with pregnancy there, with the responsibility argument, that it could be wrong for multiple reasons, some more obviously seen than others. But I don't think it amounts to a kind of red herring one should get rid of. I don't think it's as parallel to the poverty argument for abortion. Hopefully I've put everything out of my head there for just a first thought, but what do you think of that?
I think that makes sense. But yeah, I'm always interested in, you know, getting to the root of the issue. So figuring out what the primary reason is. Like, if we were trying to figure out what the primary reason for killing Cy Kellett would be, we're not going to say, oh, well, because he's a funny guy, he's the host of Catholic Answers. We would say no, because he's a human being and it's wrong to kill him.
He said it's wrong to kill me, Trent.
Yeah, it would be wrong to kill Cy because, one, he is a human being, and two, so he has intrinsic value as a human being. But one could also make an argument that Cy has instrumental value in being the host of Catholic Answers Live. But even if it were demonstrated that Cy had little to no instrumental value, his intrinsic value would still show that it would be wrong to kill him. But I believe we can grant he has both intrinsic and a high amount of instrumental value, if you're all right with that, Cy.
I like having both intrinsic and instrumental value. Both of those things make me happy.
There you go. I'm happy to oblige you. But thank you, Tom. I hope that was helpful.
Thank you for the thoughtful question. All right, back with more tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
EWTN is now on Twitter. Get short, timely messages from EWTN on your computer or cell phone. It's easy to stay up to date on a wide variety of topics. Pro-life news, Vatican announcements, catechesis, apologetics, the latest EWTN programming, and more. You can link to EWTN on Twitter from our homepage or go to twitter.com/EWTN. At work, at home, at school, and on the road, stay connected to your world with EWTN's Twitter page.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn this hour. Carlo Broussard next hour. That's pretty good Monday. Second hour, we're going to talk all about Jesus. This hour, you can talk about anything you want if you want a tip on defending the faith. Is there something about the faith that you think, I don't know how we defend that or what the proper way to explain that to somebody is? You can call 888-318-7884, and we are very happy to take your call. Let's go to Chris in Marlborough, Massachusetts, listening on EWTN. Chris, thank you very, very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just have a very easy question for you. Does the church teach that Adam and Eve did not have any children before the fall?
Yes, because the church teaches that the fall of man affected all human beings, and that the fall is something that is original sin is not something that has the character of a personal fault. So It says here in paragraph 404 of the Catechism, so 404, how did the sin of Adam become the sin of all his descendants? The whole human race is in Adam as one body of one man. By this unity of the human race, all men are implicated in Adam's sin, as all are implicated in Christ's justice. It goes on in paragraph 405 to talk about how original sin does not have the character of a personal fault. It is a deprivation of original holiness and justice. So the church firmly teaches that all human beings are affected by original sin unless they were divinely protected from it, like the Blessed Virgin or when Jesus became incarnate. But what original sin is, it's not a positive thing we get. It's an absence of God's grace and friendship. Now, prior to the fall, if Adam and Eve had had a child, that child would have been born in friendship with God as well. That the preternatural gifts that Adam and Eve received would have been passed on to their descendant. And so even if Adam and Eve then fell and rebelled against God, that would not have affected their son or daughter who did not take part in their action, but it would affect any of their descendants who they could not pass God's grace upon to. The gifts of God after the fall, Adam and Eve could not pass them on to descendants. But if Adam and Eve had children before the fall, those children, you know, there could have been other descendants from them, and then there could have been another race of human beings that never fell, but that's not what the church teaches. It says that all men have sinned. The Bible is very firm on that. Romans 5:12. Paul is very clear. Through one man, all have sinned. And then through one man's disobedience, all have sinned or been subject to death. One man's obedience, Christ, all can be brought to life or can be saved. So, yeah, no, Adam and Eve did not have any children prior to the fall. And the church
that
does teach that.
That is such a great answer. I never would have thought about all that stuff. That is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate
the call. Thank you, Chris. Yeah.
Already. We listen to you every night, and we're eating our dinner together, my husband and I. We just love it.
Do you listen?
Oh, that's fun.
Do you listen on the radio or on an app?
We're listening on the EWTN radio.
Oh, very.
On our little Alexa thing here.
Oh, your Alexa. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Marlboro's near Westboro, right?
It is. It's right next door, yeah.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I lived in Westboro.
You're from Westboro?
No, not really from there. I just one year when I was 4 or 5, I lived there.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I just remember
really
a lot of snow.
Oh, boy. You got it.
Well, have a happy winter, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Let's see who we got next. I got to go to the... Darren, tell me who we got next. I don't know. Okay, we're going to line 3, and it's Cole. Out here in San Luis Obispo, California, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Cole, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, I was wondering how I could defend the Catholic Church when it comes to the claim that in 1054, it was the Catholic Church which was schismatic and broke off from the Orthodox Church.
Yeah, I think that this gets us into some nitty-gritty when it comes to church history and the history between the Eastern and the Western Church. Are there particular arguments you've heard saying that the Catholic Church broke away from Christ's Church, like that it's left the deposit of faith, or you're just kind of wondering in general?
My friend attacks it in the sense that it took on ideas after which are heretical, and that's how he knows which one was true, not really from any historical basis.
Oh, that's interesting. What were some of the did he tell you some of the heresies?
Well, one was Thomism. He's very against Thomism and follows Palamas, and then he also just disagrees with the idea of the papacy.
Yeah, then I think basically that's the route you're going to need to go. Well, what's interesting here is, like, you're saying, okay, you're saying that the church is schismatic, broke away from Christ's church because it failed to elevate the teachings of an Eastern theologian, St. Gregory of Palamas. Although I would say, honestly, that the issues become more technical than sometimes happens in the debate between Catholics and Eastern Orthodox. First, there's a few mistaken things I think you should bring up to him and just keep your horizons broad in the dialogue between East and West. That, of course, that this is a dialogue, of course, about reunion, bringing our churches together, because we believe the Orthodox have valid holy orders. They are a church. Protestants belong to ecclesial communities. They got valid sacraments and priests. So a few things that you should help him be mindful of. Number one is that while the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas or Thomism has a privileged place in the Catholic Church, I think Pope Leo XIII did an encyclical on that, it's not the only game in town. There are other views that people can follow. People who follow SCOTUS would be one example. There are other theological schools of thought that are acceptable to Catholics that don't necessarily in line with Thomism. And there's different interpretations of Aquinas when it comes to applying his thought. So if he says, well, I'm against Catholicism because of Thomism, you say, well, there are alternatives. If he says that Thomistic thought is a heresy and the church should just condemn it, well, that gets you into a bigger tank. And I would just wonder, you know, what real problem he has with the angelic doctor, and whether he's really pushing the idea that other views that would be free to hold apart from Aquinas, no, you have to endorse those views. I'm just kind of skeptical of that lack of freedom we would have. And then even with Gregory of Palamas, I would say there that Western theologians have appraised him more with his insights, that there are ways of understanding his view of God or the energy-essence distinction that can still be in line with Catholic orthodoxy. There was a time when Gregory, I think the books had to be removed from libraries in the East, but were then eventually put back. And I believe like even Pope St. John Paul II said very positive things about Gregory of Palamas. So I think it's something that has come around more, so it's not as stark a division. And then, yeah, when it comes to the papacy, I think there you're just going to have to really, I would put the burden of proof on them just to say, well, look, why should I believe that the Christ's church, all of the apostles' successors have equal authority, that there's no one who has a chief role amongst their successors, just like Peter had a chief role among the other apostles. So I might recommend, Cole, I'd be happy to let's get your address. I would like to send you a copy of my friend Joe Heschmeyer's new book, Pope Peter. I think it's an excellent book on the arguments for the papacy. So I definitely recommend that to start. Let's get your email address and we will send that to you.
All right, hang on, Cole. It's called Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. Trent Horn is our guest. Tips for defending the faith this hour on Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Billy in Calgary, Canada, watching on YouTube. Billy, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Billy. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Great. Just want to say I've listened a long time and first-time caller, but I really appreciate what you guys do.
Oh, thank you.
I have a nephew that was raised without any religion whatsoever. He has not heard the scriptures. He probably just heard the sort of secular view, tunnel vision views of Christianity, which usually aren't too good. But I was having a conversation with him at a family gathering, and we got into religion and politics, and he seemed genuinely interested and had some really interesting questions. I guess what I'm my main question is, I can defend the existence of God. I can defend Catholicism over, say, Protestantism, with the historical context.
Sure.
I think one of the biggest questions to be able to answer is why Christianity over anything else, as like Judaism or whatever else.
I know Matt Frad did an article for our Catholic Answers magazine a while ago. He called it the Apologetics Mansion. And you build this big mansion. The first floor is the existence of God. Second floor is the person of Christ. Third floor is the Catholic distinctives. And up in the attic, you have all the moral issues hiding up there. And I think sometimes a lot of Catholics, we just get in the ground floor and we quick run up the stairs to the third floor, the second floor, I guess, Catholic distinctives in the attic. And no one wants to go to the first floor. We don't have as much material on, well, why be Christian instead of any other religion? And what I would say there is that really focusing on the unique person of Christ and to show, look, if Jesus rose from the dead, then we know all the other non-Christian religions are false because the non-Christian religions deny that Jesus is God, deny that he rose from the dead. I would focus like a laser on what is the explanation for the origin of the Christian faith. Is it a natural one, or is it that Jesus really did rise from the dead? So, Billy, what I would recommend then, I would like to send you two books. You're up in Canada. I would like to email you two books, unless someone can smuggle them across the border to you. You know, crawl under the barbed wire coated in maple syrup. I would like to send you an electronic copy of Why We're Catholic and my book Counterfeit Christ. Why We're Catholic and Counterfeit Christ. We'll email that to you, and I hope that is helpful.
Hang on, Billy. We'll get that email address. More tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn coming up right after this. If you've got a question about something you'd like to defend about the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn's our guest. And that means fun and smart answers and defending the faith. This hour, we're defending the faith. If you want tips for defending the faith, something that you just don't know how to explain to folks, don't know how to stand up to or stand up for, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You sound great today, Trent. Is it because you're drinking a black cherry seltzer right now?
Did people see that on YouTube? Yeah, I am enjoying a black cherry sparkling. I don't know if it's seltzer, it's sparkling water. I don't know if there's a difference between the two, but it is delightful. I know I should probably pour this in a glass and not have a brand, but I just didn't get around to doing that.
I don't know why black cherry soda is so good and cherry soda. No, it does. It's not good. It's not good. Black cherry is the class of the cherry family, I believe.
It has this muted taste to it. That's not because cherry is just like really can be really overpowering.
Like, I mean, I like a good Shirley Temple as much as anybody, but that's the only place I want anything cherry in there.
Right. Well, I mean, it is hard, to discern like what works and what doesn't. I'll tell you this though, I'm kind of trying to get off of soda because it's so bad for you. I don't really drink alcohol, and soda is something I've enjoyed for a long time, but I was out at lunch the other day and I heard someone talking about his health program and fitness and weight loss, and he was telling a friend like, I just tell myself when I'm about to drink a soda, you're drinking liquid candy. And I'm like, yeah, I would be gross if I just put like a chocolate bar in a blender and with water and drank it. But that's what you do when you drink
soda. I'm not convinced that soda is so bad for you because people in the Middle Ages, they had no soda and they only lived to be about 40 years old. And now we have soda and we live to be like 90 years old. So I'm not convinced. Is that logical?
That's very logical.
I figured that out myself.
By that logic, I guess that because we drink more soda in the present than in the past and we live longer, more soda increases our lifespan. So if you drank nothing but soda, you'd live to be 1,000 years old.
Yeah, but who wants to live to be 1,000 years old? They keep talking about that, like, oh, lifespans are going to vastly increase. I'm like, I'm okay with the standard lifespan. Thank you very much. All right, let's go to Seth in Illinois, listening on Catholic.com. Go ahead, Seth, with your question for Trent.
Hey, Trent. How's it going? Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
I was in a coffee shop, and I was praying. And a girl comes up to me and says, in the future, take that outside. And her justification for that was, not everybody believes what I believe, and it's a coffee shop, not a church. And I've been thinking about it for days. How do I respond to that?
Oh, wow. Now, what kind of prayer were you doing? Were you praying like vocally out loud or mentally?
I was breathing a bit heavier, but not talking out loud. I had my hands together in the common prayer position, and I was sitting at the counter with my head down, just meditating on the rosary.
So you weren't just like saying like a meal prayer with your biscotti. You were praying the rosary.
Yeah, I was meditating on my coffee because that's what I do when I drink coffee.
Yeah, sure, of course. But you weren't like, because I always, it's important for me to get like, you know, both sides of the story. Yeah, you might have been breathing a little heavier, but you weren't like making, it'd be no different than like, imagine somebody might be watching a video on their phone and they're breathing a little heavier watching this, or they're like, you know, rocking out to music and they're, you know, mouthing the words of a song. I don't think she would probably care, but she didn't like it.
Moving or like doing normal human things.
It's because it was religious. Wow. Well, I would, I guess what I would say here is, number one, I would absolutely not comply with that request because it's unreasonable. But I would use it as an opportunity to maybe charitably engage her. Just say, all right, I see what you're saying. I would just be interested to see that if this woman is so moved, because that's very rare. I've rarely ever heard of people doing that, that she's so incensed at the thought of religion that she would want to tell other people not to quietly pray in a public area. Just to ask her, like, hey, can I just ask you a question? Like, I'll buy you a coffee. Like, can you tell me, like, do you think I should be religious? Like, do you think I just should, like, I guess that'd be a question I'd have for her. Like, should I be religious, like, in private? Or is it true or is it not true? Because if it's true, I think I should just, like, celebrate it everywhere. Otherwise, if it's, she could also feel like, hey, you know, I think whatever you believe, even if it is true, don't bring it out in public. And I'd say, but if it is true, this is something that informs my entire life. Why wouldn't I do something like that? So I think I might, if you see someone is like that, I think I would just kind of be polite and say, well, no, this is important to me. I don't see you telling other people not to listen to music or books, and it's a free country. But because it's a free country, you can definitely tell me what you think about religion. I'd love to hear about it. And then if she says, I don't want to talk to you about this stuff, you could say, all right, well, you have a good day. If you ever change your mind, I'll be here praying.
She's into astrology. Should I give her an astrology book and say, hey, this is what is to you as prayer is to me?
I guess you could say, like, you could say, like, I get, if you feel comfortable with her, If you feel comfortable, I think that you can say, hey, I'm just curious. You're saying you don't like religion. Keep it in your church. Well, I don't like astrology. I think that it's false and people can take it way too seriously. But I'm not going to tell you you shouldn't sit and do your horoscope in the coffee shop. So you can start with arguing for tolerance among different beliefs. But I think it's good to move from there to get her to reconsider religion itself. Do you run into this? Do you run into her often, or is it just a one-off thing?
She works there. So.
Oh my gosh, she's an employee. Wait, she's an employee at the coffee shop and told you to stop it?
She's a new employee there, so she hasn't. I know all the other employees there. She's the only one that's. It's a small town coffee shop, so it's not like.
Yeah.
It's not like where the employee thing matters as much as it would at a big chain.
I guess, yeah. But even still, like, people are going to come in who don't normally go there. It's like, I would just say to her, like, if she brings it up again or is weird about it, I think you can just say, hey, that's not really how you should treat customers. And if you don't like it, talk to her manager. But I think you should go face-to-face with the person and be like, look, you realize it's not – if you're new working here, you shouldn't kind of be hassling people about what they're quietly doing, whatever it is in the coffee shop. If it persists, then maybe ask the manager, hey, I'd like to keep coming here, but I don't want to get this employee in trouble. But I think she said some odd things to me. Because I think you should try to give her as much grace as possible and engage her. So I tell you what, Seth, why don't I send you a copy? I'll send you two copies of my book, Why We're Catholic. So there's one you can read and one you can give her if she's up to it. So you can just keep that in your back pocket, but you can keep all that in mind. So let's send you a copy of Why We're Catholic. And ask our listeners to pray that I think this young woman, she's definitely, at least she's not apathetic. There's something to work from what's happening there. That's interesting. I haven't heard that in a while.
Seth, thanks. I'm going to put you on hold, and Thomas will get your information. We'll send you a couple copies of Why We're Catholic. Let's go to Christian in Virginia, listening on Catholic.com. Christian, go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, guys. How do Catholics interpret Romans 9 in regards to the Calvinist use of the chapter as proof of their doctrine of the elect and predestination?
Yeah, so this might be I might have to give more of a truncated answer to this question. So Romans 9, I think we have to read in the greater context of Paul's letter to the Romans. And the major theme of Paul's letter to the Romans is that God is desiring universal salvation for humankind, for humanity, and that to be a part of God's chosen people, you do not have to be a good Jew before you become a good Christian. To which Paul's Jewish interlocutors would say, well, then what the heck was all that for 2,000 years of the chosen people and circumcision and everything we went through if it didn't matter in the end? And Paul is walking a fine line saying, no, it's not true that it didn't matter, but it's also not the case that the chosen people are restricted to the Jewish people anymore, that all people through faith can come into union with Jesus Christ primarily through baptism is how we become united to Christ. So Romans 9 talks about God's choosing of Israel, why he chose them. He didn't choose them through anything special of their own merits. And we who are baptized, we don't do any special work to be brought into the kingdom of God. We're moved by faith or moved by the faith of our parents. And so when reading in Romans 9, especially when it talks about hardened hearts and vessels being made for destruction, I think it's important to keep that into focus of Romans 9 through 11 in general, with Paul's hope for salvation of all the tribes of Israel, at least every member of the tribe. The key in reading that is to say, look, Catholic biblical scholars can have different interpretations, but there's just certain lines you can't cross. And one of those lines would be double predestination. You cannot hold that God specifically destined certain people to go to hell. You can believe God chose certain people for heaven and maybe passed over others, but he gave at least some grace to make it possible for them to be saved. But you can't hold that God precisely destined a certain individual or group to be damned. So when it talks about in Romans 9:22, for God showing his wrath, vessels who have wrath made for destruction, one way of interpreting that, it's not popular among certain Greek exegetes, but others see it, is that using the middle voice, Paul is talking about vessels that made themselves for destruction, because Paul's using the middle voice there. That's a little bit of a contention. I would just say there's different ways to interpret the passage, but we need an overarching rule to follow it. And one of those would be that God does not destine people for damnation. They do that by their own choice. The other things people might use Romans 9 to say you can't lose your salvation, and that's not the case. Romans 9 may be talking, or that actually goes back to Romans 8 more, about glorification. But I would say, since we have to go to a break here, I will send you a copy of my friend Jimmy Akin's book, The Drama of Salvation. It goes into this in more detail, and I think you may find that helpful. So stick on the line. Let's get you a copy of The Drama of Salvation, and I hope that'll help clear things up. If you have more questions, definitely call back.
Thanks, Christian. Thanks very, very much. Hey, our store-wide sale is still going on. As a matter of fact, this is a great time to get stuff for Christmas because, as everybody knows, there's likely to be delays around deliveries this year, and you can get pretty much everything in the shop is 10 to 25% off, except those things that go all the way up to 50% off, and in a few cases, even more than 50% off. Just go to shop.catholic.com. Shop now. Get all that stuff on sale and have it well before Christmas. Shop.catholic.com.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I just want to share that 5 years ago, my lovely warrior princess and saint of a wife and I decided to adopt a little girl through foster care. She is the perfect roundout of our family of three boys and her. Yes, there are challenges. Very grateful today for all the blessings that he has shown our family.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teens spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Carlo Broussard getting ready for hour number two, where we're going to talk about Jesus. Why? Why would you choose to follow Jesus? That second hour. This hour, Trent Horn is with us, and we're talking about the faith and defending the faith. If you have a question about how to defend the faith, this hour is for you. And up next is Rob in Midfield, Massachusetts, listening on 1060 AM. It's Rob. Thank you so much. Thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. When we pray the Our Father, we say, Thy will be done on heaven, in heaven as it is, on earth as it is in heaven. There we go. And we want to do God's will because God is God and God knows and much better than I do. And we have, for instance, the Ignatian task of trying to discern God's will. But then... Right. We have this great gift from God, which is free will. Yes. So here's my question. Are we not somehow dismissing, it may be a little simplistic, but dismissing our free will once we choose to follow just God's will? How do I read? I know I have free will. Many non-religious people think, no, we don't have free will. We're just programmed little robots. No, we have free will. We can do good. We can do evil. And yet I want to follow God's will, and I can't fully resolve those things, so I hope you can help me. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I can. Well, imagine you're back in high school, and you're taking a calculus test, and the teacher has put out 100 questions. The teacher came up with 100 questions and picked the answers for those questions. And so the teacher has a will. The teacher would like me to... get the test right, get every question answered it right, okay? And so if I take the test and I do answer every question right And I have fulfilled my teacher's will of executing the test properly, getting all the math figured out and answering all the questions. Did I give up my free will in taking the test and marking all of the correct answers? I would say, well, no, I didn't give up my free will. I was free throughout that entire process. I could have gotten up from the test. I could have picked a different answer if I didn't feel like it. But I wanted to get 100% on the test. Now, I never got 100 in calculus because I was bad at calculus. But if I could have, I would have freely chosen to do that. The fact that there was a particular set of answers that are correct doesn't take away my free will from trying to access them. And I would say that it's similar to what God desires for us. When we freely choose it, we unite our will to his will. And so even Jesus had a fully human will and a fully divine will because he's fully God and fully man, but they were never in conflict with one another, free and in perfect harmony. Now, to the analogy is a tad limited, though, because what we choose to do in life, every decision we make, it's not the case that there is a correct answer. It's not like every decision is sin or not sin. Sometimes we might make a choice. It's not necessarily God's will, whether I choose to have Raisin Bran or Cheerios. It's just God's will that I nourish myself, and it doesn't really care which way I choose to do it as long as it's healthy. Or there could be many different occupations I could choose, being a teacher, being a firefighter, being an apologist. In some cases, for some people, certain occupations may be what God really desires for them. In other cases, God's will may be that there's a range of occupations that you could choose that would be pleasing and glorifying to him, and you'd be doing his will and choosing them. So sometimes we have, it's not just good or evil. A lot of times our free choice is from many different good options. So I would say in choosing many different good options or in getting all the answers right on the tests God has given us, I don't think we've given up our free will in any part of it, because having free will, there's different ways to define free will. But I would say, look, if I want to do it and I'm the cause of it, not God, I chose to do it, then I was free. Even though what I do, I know it's going to please God because it's what he wants me to do. But I could have chosen to not cooperate, yet I did choose to cooperate. I hope that's helped. Is that a helpful reply?
It is helpful. And I thought that would be the route that you might go. And it's good. I agree. Modestly, sure. I say I agree. I'm thinking that it really comes down to God very much wants us to be good. We have a free will, and he very much wants us to be good. But how we be good is up to us. And
yes,
in some cases, the
choice will be stark. It's good or evil. Action, inaction. Other cases, you're right, it'll be a bit more of more variety.
I'm thinking maybe that this is maybe perhaps a little silly, maybe slightly irreverent, but God's my coach and he's putting me in the game and he's saying, mm-hmm. I want you to play a good game. In other words, I want you to be good. That's what a good game is. But I'm not going to tell you who to pass the ball to. I'm not going to tell you when to shoot. I don't want you to kick the referee, though.
Don't go out of bounds. Don't double dribble. Yeah, that's not too bad of an analogy.
No, I think it's a good one. Rob, I'm going to keep moving, though, because there's a several more people who'd like to talk with Trent before we finish the hour. But thank you very much for the call. I'm going to go to June in Michigan, listening on EWTN. June, go ahead with your question for Trent.
Thank you. Yes, I was having a conversation with several Bible-based church-attending people. And they had been upset because they went to a mass and, they were instructed not to receive communion. And I was trying to explain that to them, but I don't think they didn't, my answer was not fulfilling to them. So I was hoping you'd be able to help me with something that might be a little more.
Yeah, sure. That can be hard for people to understand when they think that, well, I thought the Eucharist is just something that's just a source of strength for all of us that we all receive, and why would you say some people can't? I think the way you can find common ground with them is to say, look, there's many cases where there are Catholics who cannot receive the Eucharist, because when we receive the Eucharist, that is a sign. When we receive the Eucharist and say amen, we say amen, at least in the Western Church, but when we choose to receive the Eucharist, you are affirming that you are in communion with Christ and his church. So if you are out of communion with the church or out of communion with Christ, you must not receive him. So if you're in a state of mortal sin, for example, you're not in communion with Christ. You're still a part of the church, but there's a barrier, if you will. You've been cut off in a sense because of your sin. Now you're still a part of the church because you can go to confession, be reconciled to God, be reconciled to the church. But if you're in mortal sin, you're not in full communion with Christ's church. Much the same way, if you are not Catholic, you're not in full communion with the church. That in receiving the Eucharist, we are saying to God and saying to everyone, I am in complete communion with the Catholic Church. I affirm what the church teaches. I am in a state of grace to receive Jesus into my soul. And so if you're not Catholic, you simply cannot make that affirmation. You're receiving Jesus. You might not even believe that that's Jesus. And to say, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, to say that there are people who ate and drank the body and blood of the Christ of Christ without discerning the body, without discerning this is really Jesus, brought spiritual and physical harm to themselves. So that might be one approach that I would take. Is that helpful, June?
Well, we kind of got to that point, and
okay,
they discount saying, well, basically that, well, my church is good as a Catholic church, and you know, we're all Christians. And then I asked them, I said, well, do you believe that communion is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ?
Right.
And they said, yes, which, well.
And then I'd have to say to them, I'd say, do you have a priest? Well, are they, well, I guess, like, okay, what denomination are they? They might, if they're Anglican or something like that. But as you said, they're Bible-based.
No, it's, yeah.
Yeah, so they probably have a pastor.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess what I would ask them is...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I would ask them, why do you have a pastor instead of a priest? Why don't you have a priest? Why would anyone need a priest? You need a priest to offer sacrifice. That's specifically why most Protestants do not have priests. The closest would be Anglicans, though the church has said their orders are no longer valid. Because they haven't maintained the correct sacramental theology, but especially Bible-based churches that come out of the Baptists and other continental reformers, Luther, Calvin, that in most of those cases you have pastors, you don't have priests, especially among the Baptists. And you ask them, look, a priest is one who offers sacrifice. We believe that the sacrifice of Calvary, of Jesus on the cross, is represented under the form of bread and wine. To present a sacrifice to God, only a priest can do that. So you might believe your communion meal is the Eucharist, is this sacrifice, but then I would say, well, who has the authority to do that? Only a priest does. And where does a priest get that authority? He gets it from a bishop, who gets it from another bishop, who gets it from the apostles, from their successors. And when you read the very first church fathers, they made it clear that communion with Christ's church is found in obeying the bishops as Jesus Christ obeyed the Father, to quote St. Ignatius of Antioch. June, stay on the line. I'd like to send you a copy of Why We're Catholic. And then if you would like to hand out copies to your friends, you can always go to shop.catholic.com. You can get 20 copies for $60. Go to shop.catholic.com, but we'll send you a free copy of Why We're Catholic, and I hope that will be helpful for you. But thank you so much. And I hope you have a very good day. Thank you.
Thanks, June. Trent Horn, our guest this hour. Next hour, Carlo will be here, and we're going to talk about why I believe in Jesus. So if you've got questions about why I believe in Jesus, anybody can call, but it would be great if some folks who do not believe in Jesus would like to talk to us about why we believe in Jesus or why we believe you should believe in Jesus. 888-318-7884. Trent, tell them where to get your podcast again, because I know that podcast is just growing and growing.
Definitely go to, you can search for it, Council of Trent on YouTube and also Google Play and iTunes, Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, if you'd like to support it and get access to our catechism series, our New Testament video series, entire New Testament, entire catechism we study. That's available at TrentHornPodcast.com. TrentHornPodcast.com.
You can get all that stuff, but I like the response videos where it's like
Mondays, responses, dialogues, lots of great stuff. Check that out.
Yeah, sure. All kinds of cool stuff. And it's great to have a place on the internet where you can go, where
a good, solidly Catholic person is talking in a charitable and inquisitive and humane way with folks of all different persuasions. So head over to TrentHornPodcast.com. Hey, Carlo's coming up in a minute, so if you want to talk about why I believe in Jesus, give us a call, 888-318-7884.